Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this workshop for this afternoon. I'm delighted to welcome you here. I know some of you have travelled some distance to be here, and that's a reflection of the speakers we have lined up for you this afternoon. Thank you. This is an important development for the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. We're organising this jointly with the Department of Sociology at the University of Manchester, whom we give grateful thanks for the coordination. But it's also something of a new departure for the Observatory, because we aren't often able to have a social or indeed sociological dimension to the discussions that we have in our lectures and seminars. Many of our public events focus on the politics, many of them focus on the economics, perhaps too much on the economics. Can we get too much economics? I think quite easily we can get too much economics discussion in the present situation. So it's important for us to be looking at the relevance of social theories, sociology, to the current crisis. And indeed, I've been struck in recent times when having discussions with bankers and people in financial institutions here, for example, in the City of London, something of a gradual awakening, a gradual shift of attitude in them coming to appreciate that the political and the social dimensions of the crisis are increasingly important, even from their own perspective of trying to assess what might happen to Greece in the context of the Eurozone and the sovereign debt crisis. There was such a seminar here at the LSE this week, where a number of financiers and hedge fund people, all of those people we instinctively love and crave to have some contact with, were increasingly recognising that the social dimension is perhaps the most fundamental aspect as to trying to judge what will happen with Greece, what will happen with other states in difficulty in the Eurozone. And it's therefore very timely that we have this session here this afternoon. I'm delighted, of course, that we have such a stellar lineup, and I'm going to introduce them to you in a moment. Can I just give some logistical advice to you? And I'll do this despite the mobile phones and despite the distraction of a blip. And that is to say that we will need to finish this session slightly early, only slightly early. There will be a break for you to have lunch, find lunch, coffee, whatever you wish. And then the rest of the afternoon will be relocated. We will be in another building, in another room, for the workshops for this afternoon. And let me explain where they will be. They will be in the European Institute building, which is Cowdray House, opposite the pub, George IV pub. You may wish to have lunch there in advance. And it will be in room 111, which simply means that it is on the first floor of Cowdray House. And it is the room, the seminar room, immediately at the top of the stairs or immediately outside the elevator in that building. Follow the crowd, and you will hopefully get there. To start us off for this conference, we have two speakers who I'm sure are very well known to you. Some of their details are in the conference programme, which you've already been given. But to start off with a session on the relevance of social theory to the current crisis, we could hardly have two better speakers than our two speakers this afternoon. Margaret Archer is the Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick. As many of you will know, she has written seminal works on questions of culture and agency. She has developed a morphogenetic approach to questions of structure and agency. She was the first female president of the International Sociological Association. She has written over 20 books, many articles. More recently, Making Our Way Through the World, Human Reflexivity and Social Mobility, and Structure, Agency and the Internal Conversation. We very much look forward to her presentation to start off the discussions here this afternoon. Our second speaker, Nikos Mouzelis, will equally be well known to you. It would be almost impossible to claim to be Greek and not know of Nikos Mouzelis' works. Nikos has written extensively on questions of sociological theory, questions of modernization, populism, bureaucracy. His works on Greece are very well known to an international audience. Greece, politics in the semi-periphery, facets of underdevelopment, modernization, etc. But this is a special pleasure in welcoming Nikos back to the LSE on each of the occasions he's been back to speak to us. And that is something of a personal effect, in the sense that Nikos Mouzelis was the academic lead for the establishment of the Eleftherios Venizelos Chair in Contemporary Greek Studies, and therefore, by extension, the academic lead for the establishment of the Hellenic Observatory. So we owe him much of an academic debt, also in that very specific sense. For this session, I'm going to invite firstly Margaret and then Nikos to speak to us for basically however long they wish, but as a guide, perhaps 30, 40 minutes. And then that will leave us with plenty of time for discussion, raising themes which can then be explored more particularly in the workshops after lunch. Let me take this opportunity to thank everybody who's been involved in the organisation, the collaboration between the Observatory and the University of Manchester, but in particular, of course, you must already be aware the programme being established and set up, the idea of the conference, the creation of my colleague Athanasia Halari, who is with us here. She was with the Observatory for this academic year. It's a wonderful initiative she's taken, so our thanks to Athanasia for doing so. So welcome. Without further ado, we now start the academic substance. I invite Margaret Archer to address us, please.
Thank you very much for that, and thank you for the invitations. I feel a complete fraud because I am not going to be talking to you about Hellenic hedge funds, Dodecanese derivatives, and other things that will probably be much more relevant today than what I am going to talk about. There is just one interesting little bridge between myself and Nikos, which is quite relevant, I think, to the situation that Greece finds herself in. Not exclusively, because I think this is an extreme exemplar of the situation that all European countries find themselves in, including here. And quite a long time ago, and completely independently, both Nikos and I wrote an article about David Lockwood's distinction between systems integration and social integration, in which both of us, taking rather different routes to it, nevertheless came to one conclusion, I think, in common, but you can disavow this if you want to, that when social integration becomes very low, in combination with systems integration also becoming low, you have a very explosive situation. And I think in gross terms, the most gross macro terms, this is the crisis that European society generically is suffering from at the moment. It's much more pointed and poignant in Greece. The fact that I'm not going to be talking about it doesn't mean I don't care about it. The human suffering is monumental. It's purely out of ignorance, and I think the best respect you can show when you are incompetent is to leave it to those who do know. So I'm afraid that's my contribution on Greece, except insofar as the whole question of reflexivity, how, well, I'll give you my definition and put it up on the overhead in a second. Reflexivity is not a peculiar psychological characteristic or type. It's an activity that everybody engages in. Not in the same way, and not in the same way over time. And interestingly, in 1934, Lev Vygotsky, the great and rather oppressed Russian psychologist, psycholinguist, put out a call internationally for a history of reflexivity. Vygotsky, appreciating that it was not the same thing from time to time and from place to place. And sadly, well, you know roughly what happened to Vygotsky. The bad guys came again, and the safest thing to do in Russia was to get on measuring things quietly in a laboratory. And that's just what they did. The Western folks don't have the same excuse for why they didn't heed his call, but they didn't. And so we have a bizarre thing in the history of reflexivity, let alone the history of reflexivity. Look at my basic definition. Reflexivity, the regular exercise of the mental ability shared by all normal people, normal's just used in the everyday sense of the word, to consider themselves in relation to their social contexts and vice versa. Now, I maintain, contra just about everybody in LSE who's written a word on reflexivity, that everybody does it and everybody always has done it, not necessarily to the same extent and not necessarily, well, I'm going to be arguing, not at all in the same way. But this kind of reflexivity is absolutely rock bottom. It's what happens when somebody graduates and they ask themselves, what job should I take? It's what happens to a young couple when they say, where are we going to live? Now, yes, some of this is external conversation, but all of us have to make our own ways through the world by identifying what we care about and what we can do to try and bring what we care about to pass. And that's why we have to consult our social contexts, because one of my absolutely fundamental convictions, there are very few that I go to the stake for theoretically, but that action always takes place in a context is one of them. There is no such thing as decontextualized action. And changes in the context in which one, all of us, engage to varying extents in reflexive activities is profoundly affected by the context in which we find ourselves. Now, I'm going to give you a historic panorama about the ways in which reflexivity changes over time, becomes more extensive, increases in scope, and differentiates in the mode by which it's practiced. But it is always indispensable to there being a social order at all. In other words, no society, no reflexivity, no reflexivity, no society. Why? Even though it is historically variable in degree and in kind. Why? Well, four reasons. First of all, you have to know reflexively which of societies, we're not reifying it, but it's got no capital, which of the expectations of your place, locality, time actually apply to you. That's something about the self that I'm not going to go into. It's something about personal emergent powers, which I'm not going to go into. But it's no use, put it this way, it's no use being a young Zandi warrior and learning by rote that, you know, at approximately this age, just after puberty, this is when a Zandi warrior takes himself a bride. Well, yeah, they can learn that as they learn how to sharpen spears and everything else they do. But unless that particular warrior says that cultural message from my tribe applies to me, I've got to do something about getting myself a bride and becoming a fully fledged Zandi warrior. But that personal application is the indispensable link between the issuing of injunctions and somebody doing something about it. Now, what they do is another whole big story, which, again, we won't go into. So that's the first reason. It has to be owned. There is no such thing as the Parsonian passive socialization process in which values, expectations, norms are tipped in like a can and they just percolate down the human being. Secondly, it is always, reflexivity that is, needed for coping with the unexpected contingencies that I would, as a realist, argue are characteristic of the social order. However well you try and codify anything, anywhere, something unpredicted happens, somebody has to cover that. They can only do it by reflexively thinking about that problem situation, as the great American pragmatist all acknowledged, and reflexively deciding what course of action to take. At which point, of course, they can all start talking to one another, and it can become an externalized group decision about what we do when the water holes dried up or the wildebeestie haven't turned up or whatever. So essential. Third reason for coping with role clashes, because as the whole history of social theorizing has shown, it's a very nice abstract model that all roles are neatly dovetailed. There's a nice value system that they all draw on, like the telephone exchange, and there aren't any difficulties on the ground. Well, we know that there are. And one of the ways in which that is dealt with, solved, would not be the right word because that implies adaptation. One of the ways that is solved is by people reflexively thinking about their role occupancy, what they want to achieve as a person in it, and how hard they will fight the other guys who have a different interpretation in this clashing situation. Only the person can do it, and I think the best example of it is actually Antigone, because there is Antigone, she does know the rule book. Trouble is, the rule book conflicts. She cannot show due obedience to King Creon, her uncle, and simultaneously behave as a normatively good sister and go and bury her brother outside the city walls. Now, in that situation of role clash, loyal subject versus good sister, Only Antigone reflexively can make up her own mind. She's going to die anyway, but she has a choice in which cause she will die, or probably will die. And that is, to me, one of the most important plays, because the history of sociology has rather traduced the number of times we're put in conflicting situations and then creatively make our own attempt to live with it or choose the way we die with it. Finally, the most important reason of all for why we should attend to reflexivity, namely that it's the only way I can think of in which structure and culture affect us without withdrawing our personal powers as people. They are not hydraulics, they are not pushes and pulls, they are not matters of simple internalization and then externalization. people have to weigh them under their own knowledge of their circumstances. Their epistemology is not a direct reflection of the reality that they face. It's a description on which they act, but it's a description in their own terms, under their own descriptions. And reflexivity is crucial to how people actually do this in particular cases. So I think I've said enough about why reflexivity is important. Let me now move on to the second part, which is how it varies over time, how it is not simply a homogeneous entity in the way that, even the great American pragmatists said it was homogeneous in kind, or didn't say anything to imply it wasn't, so that's Peirce through Dewey. It's the same there in Beck and his followers, where you can have more of it or less of it, but you're having more or less of the same thing. It's homogeneous in kind. And it's the same with Bourdieu, who says practically nothing, despite what some of his followers have written. I worked with Bourdieu in the 60s, and nobody could have been less interested in reflexivity and remained faithful to that belief to his death. He said it was something possible to a small bunch of academics working in conjunction with one another. And all the rest is Loïc Vacon making fantasy out of footnotes. So we have this huge tradition of reflexive homogeneity that you can boringly track through the ages, with this thing about it's all the same in kind. Now, when I started doing empirical work, which came as a great shock to the system, even though LSE had once upon a time trained me for it, people would say to me, and it's a difficult thing to interview people on reflexivity, because there is deep in many cultures, the furthest I got was Romania, where they say exactly the same as they say in English. Talk to myself, well, I'm not crazy. And it takes a long, well, not a long time, but it takes quite a bit of explanation that, yes, when you are calculating which route should I take on the underground, and you're doing this inside your own head, circle and district or cut through the middle. That's internal conversation. It's not very interesting, but that's what it is. When you are standing at the side of a road, is it safe to cross? That's internal conversation, which is not only in words, it's about emotions, it's about visceral feelings, it's about visual memories, and all of that. Cutting to the chase, because we haven't got long, it's not a typology. These are real people. If you want to call them anything, they are extreme types. I'm going to be talking about the dominant types. Communicative reflexives. People who can start an internal conversation, but they need the input from an interlocutor to say, yeah, you're right, go for it, do it, that's okay, whatever. Now, they're not incapable of initiating it, they're incapable of completing it and acting upon it. And we'll say quite a bit more about them in a bit. Autonomous reflexives are those who do it all by themselves. Now, we all practice all of these modes every part of the day. In my new book, yes, plug, out in 2 weeks' time, called The Reflexive Imperative, CUP, and I don't know the price, I make up a little story to show that we all use it every day. I won't repeat it here, but just very briefly, there's a guy who hasn't had much experience with dental problems. He's got a sudden agonizing pain there. And he asks around his mates, work, neighborhood, and they say, oh, you know, you may need it out. You do need to see a dentist. So that's his communicative bit. He knows there's something wrong. They've confirmed where he should go, what he should do. Then, in autonomous mode, as it were, he crosses the road perfectly competently. And he sees a dental sign. He heads towards it. And when he gets there, he looks at it, and it looks a very expensive dental practice. So as a meta-reflexive who is not grinding in agony, he thinks, no, I'll walk on a bit. He criticizes his own first internal impulse to go to the nearest dentist he can see. And he walks on till he finds another practice. So that's his meta-reflexive moment. In the practice he eventually enters, unfortunately there's a harridan of a receptionist who tells him how painful extractions are, confirming something he has rather believed in all along. And he just mutters, well, I'll think about it, I'll come back. It's a sort of fractured mode moment. And we leave the story there because we don't know how it turns out. So when I'm using these dominant modes, it's not to say we don't use the other ones, we do. But most of us do have a dominant mode, and what's more importantly, these change in terms of their representation in the population over time, over history. So has everybody got an idea of what a meta-reflexive is? Somebody who voices a thought and then criticizes their own thought before they've done anything. And this can go on for a very, very long time. I suspect it's one of the things that's going on in Greece and other movements at the moment. What is the best thing to do? And fractured reflexives are rather the casualties of these circumstances in which they find themselves. Empirically, I found it was most closely associated with real adversity like unemployment, unexpected broken relationships, or things just like the crisis where people are losing their homes, jobs, pay is going down, and all the things you know better than I do. Now, what's the point of mentioning all of this? Might seem like a sort of luxury for quiet times. And it is to theorise about it. But I'm going to give you a brief history of reflexivity, which is meant to illustrate, the book argues for it and defends it and warrants it, I hope. But the argument is a very basic one, that the key thing about developing communicative reflexivity is that you have a context, action, there is no contextless action, but you have a context which is continuous over large tracts of time. It's very typical of traditional societies, early societies, whatever we want to call them. The contextual continuity means that yesterday's solutions usually work today and probably will work tomorrow. You can learn by imitation. You have a low amount, to go back to Durkheim, a low amount of structural differentiation and a low amount of cultural ideational differentiation. People are similars and familiars, and that's how they can consult one another. Why do they need to be reflexive at all? Because contingency happens even in the best organized early society, back to the water holes. But because things are done by imitation and informal induction, there's no formal education, communicative reflexivity is very conventionalist normatively. This is how we do things around here. This is how things were always done. Anybody who puts forward, and this is very interesting, if somebody has an innovative idea, as Ernest Gellner maintained, happens in every kind of society, including the earliest, somebody is just a sharper knife. Better witch doctor, eye for the main chance, as Gellner put it. Primitive societies are not completely homogeneous, perfect examples. The way that we have been brought up to treat the Azandi, which I'm sure is to mistreat them. And so communicative reflexivity is exercised, probably not very extensively, but it will be the dominant form. Now, this is because in these early societies, structure and culture are reinforcing one another. As Weber showed in the ancient India, ancient Chinese study, they may even have come to have interpenetrating elites, the religious elite, the Brahmanate, the literati. These are kind of straddling roles across the culture structure divide. And as you can see, it just goes round and round in reinforcement. Not forever, because there are external interventions. There are wars, conquests, discoveries, and people leave. Now, to go back a second and do the appalling thing, but it's very common around here, so I don't mind doing it in Houghton Street, talking about modernity as if it was one thing, one big chunk. It isn't, and a very interesting thing would be to look at classical Greek society as and in the city-state format, which is very different from talking about mercantile Florence or talking about early industrialized Europe. But just for ease of presentation, because I've got to speed up, modernity is about change. It's one thing Max Weber and Durkheim and Zimmel were fully agreed upon. It's not about fast change. And that's often not noticed, except by odd people like Emmanuel Wallerstein, who wants to talk about globalization beginning slowly in the 16th century. And correctly, I think. But one of the effects of it happening at all is that it prompts contextual discontinuity for increasingly large tracts of the population. Certainly not everybody at first, maybe not everybody for centuries, but the move from rural to urban living, the move from agriculture to factory production, the move from subsistence to wage labour, and everything that those all imply. These are contextual discontinuities for the people who are affected. They are very slow ones. To begin with, they only involve a minority of the population, those few who are attracted to the medieval towns in the first place. Then, as structure and culture become more and more out of sync, and you have the great war of ideologies, then people are more and more confronted with discontinuities in ideas. So take a worker in one of the new factories. There's no continuity. He doesn't know what is expected of him. She doesn't know what's expected of her. And when in Britain Luddism, Chartism, and all of the industrial movements that led up to unionisation first got going, this was a very slow movement, very difficult, reflexive position that the worker was put in. Standing there, mining coal, making first forms of steel production, and somebody is nagging at him to go and do some loom breaking in the next village, or to sign the charter, or to join one of the early unions. Now, those workers have got to do a reflexive job for the first time in their newly discontinuous lives. They've got to weigh the promise of better things tomorrow through organisation, but probably a lockout, loss of wages for the week, starving family in the background. Now, that will be the first time that they've had to do cost-benefit analysis of that kind. And that's why, given the competitive nature of capitalism itself and the fact that all institutions in a market economically dominated by capitalism are competitive also. So what is education like? It's the way that those who fought and struggled to shape it in one way rather than another won out, and they did so differently in different countries. But the story of its shaping is a story of struggle. It's a story of discontinuity. And these increased in speed until we got to a point where morphogenesis is contextually encouraged, because for the first time, it's going to jump forward, structure and culture are coming back into a very interesting but completely unique situation where cultural change passes over the intersection, that's just a metaphor of course, and encourages structural elaboration through the things that you are very, very familiar with, the applications of science to production, R&D, so forth and so on. Structural elaboration passes over the divide and begins to make things hot up on the cultural front. Best example, of course, is the internet, cyber communities, cyber entertainment, etc., etc., etc. Change gets faster and faster. Now, it's a very difficult statement to actually vindicate empirically. Just writing a long thing on how it's almost impossible to do it, because as a new change appears, quite often an old item, as information theorists would call it, falls into disuetude. So, put it quite simply, when television came along, the increase in television sales meant a decrease in radio sales and radio listening. So, it's not just measure what's new. But there are novelties, and the whole mechanism behind societal morphogenesis is for variety, to stimulate more variety. This is one of the games that our rapacious universities are playing. How can they raid the research funding market for new innovations, new novelties, with new impact factors, and all the rest of the story you know only too well. Now, one of the conclusions that was drawn from that, which I think is entirely, wholly, and utterly mistaken, was that the structure of society vanishes. In fact, there is a process of destructuring. I just won't produce the word structuration. Some of you will know why. So this will be destructuration, which we get in Beck. Institutionalized individualism is all that's left. But in the absence of social structures, it's the self-culture of the individual. I mean, it's amazing how traditional, liberal, mainstream, and basically capitalist this thinking is. It's not a real third way at all. It's what we've got now at the moment in our coalition government here. Where probably the most serious thing that Beck is going wrong over, agents cannot act in a rational and responsible manner. That's with reference to the consequences of their actions for themselves. So he has no time for reflexivity, and a fascinating footnote to Reflexive Modernization, in which he said this book is not about reflexivity at all. It just seemed like a sexy title, so we used it. Now, have I got 5 more minutes and then stop? What's the relevance of all this to, I'm having to jump lots and lots, to the current crisis? Well, the whole reason I've been talking about reflexivity in the context of the current crisis is that reflexivity to me is how structures are things that influence people. It's how people reflect upon them that determines what they do about them. If we don't allow for that personal power of reflexivity, then we are stuck with empiricist explanations about what most of the people do most of the time. And sociologists will often settle for a lot less. What a statistically significant number of people at the 0.5 level have done somewhere at some time. Now, these are not explanations, because they're just Humean constant conjunctures. Constant conjunctions at best lead you via induction into unjustified predictions. And so we need this mediating mechanism. Now, you can criticize reflexivity for being the one, the only one, most important one, any of that, but you need a mechanism. Now, what often seems to get forgotten, and I'm very aware of this now, I don't live in England, I work in England any longer, is when you listen to the radio reports, Greece, Britain, Wall Street, anywhere, we seem to forget to mention we are still living in finance capitalism. We're not just living in a rabbit warren of hedge funds, derivatives, and things that can have a technical fix or a technocratic fix, which is how they tried to sell Mario Monti as the solution to Italy's problems. Finance capitalism is still capitalism. And in a sense, that is the problem. Because modes of reflexivity have gone on changing. Empirically, in the new book, I show how meta-reflexivity is becoming more preponderant, as is fractured reflexivity. Now, where I'm going to end up is, and it's very hard on you to ask you to take these statements on trust, but they are empirically based. Communicative reflexivity is in decline. Now, if I'm right about that, and you can put all of these as if-then statements, if I'm right about that, that's a sign that normative cohesion, conventionalism, are reducing fast. That the people, the communicative reflexives, who used to be the social cement producing the integration, generating it from generation to generation, day to day, they're diminishing. Why? Because their context is not one of continuity any longer. It hasn't been for, well, it depends where you're talking about. In Britain, it hasn't been that way for 100 years, 150 years. In Greece, it's probably a shorter period. The main fabricators of what bonds society together, the communicative reflexives, are diminishing by the day. Autonomous reflexivity is still stable. The huge multinational firms and some of the finance, huge finance companies, well, you can read it two ways. They are showing a different kind of face. The face they want to present is that of corporate social responsibility. Many of the students at Warwick that I interviewed bought into this and thought it was good faith. In other words, capitalists had a change of heart, and we could believe them. They cared about their local environments of production, their own workers, and they cared about gender fairness, and it was good to have some handicapped people promoted on a quota. You can read it the other way. The autonomous reflexives are beneficiaries of the way in which most social institutions follow the same competitive logic, performance indicators, winners and losers, fight for your child's school place, fight another sick person for a hospital bed. And the autonomous reflexive is really homo economicus, rational choice theories, rational man, is very at home in treating things like a chain of care homes for old people as a business. And there are more and more businesses around. And the autonomous reflexive's reaction to the crisis is, how can we get back to business as usual as fast as possible? You don't contemplate anything other than maybe another injection of corporate responsibility into capitalist finance. I saw a poster, a wonderful poster in Warwick yesterday outside the business school. It said, beyond, and beyondism is the social theorist's dream. Every theorist is a beyondist, if they're not an afterist or a beforeist. They're always a beyondist. And this said, beyond corporate social responsibility. And I thought, what's coming next? And then I looked at the bottom of the poster. Whose was it? Deloitte's. So much for beyondism. Meta-reflexives are on the increase, and so are, as I've said, and I'll finish in 1 minute if that's okay. So are fractured reflexives. Well, I talked about the communicative decline and the autonomous staying pretty stable, meaning that in every country that crisis hits, there are the bailout boys, usually boys, but I'm not being sexist about it, I mean, there may be a few girls, saying, Tina, there is no alternative, Mrs. Thatcher's great contribution to political philosophy, political economy. There is no alternative, so how do we get back to business as usual? The meta-reflexives who are on the increase, suffering, going through hell with this, because they can't really articulate an alternative. Many of us believed in a civil economy, well, I still do, a civil economy and a really robust civil society, and subsidiarity and solidarity. But we were just having a talk before we got together, and civil society is a victim of crisis as much as anything else is. It's not very resilient. And so we have two sad things which I'll finish on, because this is not a very optimistic talk, I'm afraid. One is, what are the meta-reflexives? This is just done by interview. They support a civil economy. They want to work in one. They want to work in an NGO or an INGO and that sort of thing. And they are very active in the Occupy groups in Madrid, in Wall Street, and in Geneva. These are the ones that I know at first hand, a little bit. But none of them have framed an alternative. It's very revealing that they're called, were first called Andignados in Spain, the indignant, the same in French, in Geneva. We protest, but we protest intransitively. We're indignant, but we're intransitively indignant. We're not indignant about something. And when, I was just telling this anecdote before we came in, when Radio 4 was interviewing some of the Occupy St. Paul's group and got a leader, or what they chose to call a leader, and they asked, it was a hymn, you know, what are you occupying for? What are you protesting about? And he said, austerity. In other words, there's no alternative. There's discomfort, there's indignation, it shouldn't be like this, but no alternative. And then the last thing we get, because social integration has dropped so much, because we have a major deficit of social integration within the whole entirety of Europe, what was very revealing were the summer riots in Britain. And I would suspect, but I'll leave it to others, you know, that this might be coming Athens' way. And what was very interesting in terms of there is no alternative, or we can't articulate it, was the poverty and immorality of the social theorists in response to it. I was absolutely outraged to read the British Sociological Association's a talk given by Zygmunt Bauman saying, these are defective consumers. No, they're not defective consumers. They are indignant people. They're engaging in expressive action, because what one really needs to happen to have a protest movement that leads somewhere is not just numbers, which we'll get from the fractureds who are just expressing their fury. Yes, their numbers, their support, and their genuine indignation is necessary. But until meta-reflexives get somewhere in articulating an alternative, and maybe that's, you know, a bit of work for the civil economy that we could do as social theorists, then we will have sporadic outbursts, signs of low systems integration, low social integration, but no articulated vision of what the alternative to Tina is.
Thank you, Margaret, very much. Sets the themes up very well. We now pass to Nicholas.
So, I don't know how to get the PowerPoint off on
me. I can help.
I want, first of all, to thank Kevin and Athanasia for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to feel again in such a well-known environment. So my talk is about social developments leading to the Greek crisis. Usually explanations about the crisis are polarized. Either they focus on internal developments, usually the modernizers focus on problems within Greece, whereas the left, they focus on external developments, on the global markets, etc. What I will try to do is look at developments both on the global level, the European level and the national level, from the 70s onwards. From the 70s onwards, because on the global level we have the development of neoliberal globalization, particularly after 1974 with the petrol crisis. On the European level, from the 70s onwards, we have a greater integration of Greece into Europe. And on the national level, we have the creation of the post-dictatorial political system that we usually call metapolitευση, that is to say the political regime which started after 1974. Now, on the global level, the first thing to point is that the type of globalization that we experience today is not unique. We had a similar development in the 19th century from 1860 till the First World War, where again we had phenomena like the sudden opening of world markets, huge inequalities, both within nation states and between nation states, and also a hegemonic power legitimizing and coordinating the world system. In the 19th century it was Great Britain, today still is, I think, the United States. But present neoliberal globalization has three unique elements. The first one is that world market mechanisms have penetrated the periphery of nation states in a way which was unimaginable in the 19th century. One has to think of any sort of global enterprise, like Sony, for instance, which has branches not only in all countries, in all the capitals of all countries, but also in small towns in every country. Now, this meant that the state has lost a lot of its autonomy. The state has not shrinked. On the contrary, very often it grows, it becomes larger, it has new functions, but in certain very key areas it loses control. And one of these key areas is the movements of capital. It is very difficult to control the movements of capital within national boundaries, which means that given this extraordinary mobility of capital, which has of course to do with the new technologies, there is an imbalance between capital and labor, in the sense that labor does not have the same type of mobility. And therefore, whereas, let's say, in the 18th century, there was again an imbalance between capital and labor, because labor was not organized, or it was not allowed even to organize, today you have a similar imbalance, not because labor is not organized, but because labor or the state cannot control capital, and therefore whenever capital is inconvenienced either by trade unions or the state, it simply goes elsewhere where labor is cheap, social legislation very lenient, and conditions of work primitive. Now, how is all this relevant for Greece? Even before the crisis, enterprises in the north of Greece has moved to Bulgaria and to other Balkan countries where labor is very cheap, social legislation very loose, and conditions of work not so good. And of course that created unemployment and a lot of hardship, particularly in northern Greece. With the crisis, not only investments have moved outside Greece, but also deposits, another form of capital, has moved abroad, as we all know. Billions of euros left Greece, which created, of course, a huge liquidity problem in the Greek financial markets. So this, it seems to me, is a dimension that you have to take into account very seriously in explaining the present crisis. Moving now to the European level, as is well known, there's a marked cleavage as far as the Eurozone is concerned between the northern and the southern countries. Countries like Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal are less competitive than countries in the north. And this has to do for a variety of reasons. Probably the most important is that in these countries you have late industrialization. they industrialized about 100 years later than England, France, Germany. And this late industrialization, if one links it with the development of parliamentarism, you realize that you have a linkage which is different from what happened in Northern Europe. That is to say, parliamentarism developed before industrialization, whereas in Western Europe it's the other way around. And therefore, parliamentary institutions, which started very early, for instance, in Greece, they took a marked clientelistic character, which remains up to date. Now, it seems to me, given this situation, a concept which is useful for analyzing the relationships between North and South within the Eurozone is the concept of unequal exchange. Now, in the sociology of development in the 60s, a similar concept, like the concept of unequal exchange, was quite dominant in the neo-Marxist approach to development and underdevelopment, in the works of Guttenfrank, Baran, and others. The theorist who theorized the concept of unequal exchange in a very sort of rigorous manner by using mainly sort of Marxist concepts was Argyri Emmanuel. The idea was that you had a systematic transfer of resources from third world countries to first world countries, from the periphery to the metropolitan center, by either political mechanisms or economic mechanisms. Political mechanisms when colonialism was still dominant, and economic mechanisms, market mechanisms, in the post-colonial period. Therefore, because of these mechanisms, you had what they used to call the development of underdevelopment. Third world countries were not developing, but underdeveloping. Now there was a serious critique of this theory mainly by a theorist called Bill Warren. And he argued that it is wrong to think that, let's say, foreign investments in a country underdeveloped this third world country. On the contrary, they developed this country. When you have foreign investments, particularly in situations where you have a developmental state, like in Southeast Asia, Korea, even China today, you have an authoritarian type of capitalism which is very effective and leads to development. But now if we move to the Eurozone, it seems to me that the concept of unequal exchange is much more relevant, because in fact you do have a systematic transfer of resources from the south to the north, because the south is less competitive, and because you do not have, at least in Greece, considerable foreign investments as in third world countries. And you do not have considerable foreign investment because You don't have cheap labor. For a variety of reasons, you cannot reduce the cost of labor to third world level for political reasons. And also you have a very anti-developmental state. The state from the 19th century up to today is profoundly anti-developmental. It creates all sorts of obstacles to foreign investment. And everybody who is in has experience of the Greek bureaucracy knows about that. Therefore, here Argyris' theory about unequal exchange, it seems to me, is quite relevant for understanding what is happening. Now, in addition to this constant, systemically produced transfer of resources from the south to the north, you have a neoliberal policy, mainly by Germany, by Mrs. Merkel, which aggravates the situation considerably. Because according to Mrs. Merkel's explanation of the crisis, the causes of the crisis are overborrowing. And the remedy are structural reforms on the one hand and austerity measures on the other. And it is only once the debt is reduced very much in the south, it is the precondition for them moving to greater political integration. In other terms, political integration should be based on fiscal discipline. Once you have fiscal discipline, then things will get better, you are going to have development, and you will have political integration. Even it was suggested that a balance in the budget of the states should be a precondition for remaining within the Eurozone, even one should inscribe into our institutions the necessity of a balanced budget, which from a Keynesian point of view, it's an absurdity. That is to say, to have in your constitution the idea that if you get into a severe crisis, you cannot, for instance, spend more in order to encourage development. Now, the point is that as far as structural reforms are concerned, of course there should be structural reforms, but you cannot reform basic institutions in an express way. It is not possible, for instance, to reform the tax services of the state in a few months, because these services are as inadequate as the rest of the Greek state. And despite the fact that there have been many reforms of the Greek state, the Greek state is highly inefficient and corrupt, and this simply does not change from one day to another. Simply impossible. As far as austerity measures are concerned, first of all, they are recessionary. They have aggravated the economic situation very much, and also the way in which they are implemented, austerity measures, are unjust. And they are unjust for two reasons. First of all, because you cannot really tax. Many left-wing people say, well, you tax the middle classes and popular classes, and you don't tax the rich. Simply, you cannot tax the rich because, as we said, capital goes away. You cannot anymore tax capital. The only thing you can tax, as far as the rich people are concerned, is buildings, houses, and so forth. And then you have a great deal of taxation. But apart from that, you cannot, I mean, even if you have a socialist government, you simply cannot tax capital. It goes away. You cannot tax deposits because they go away. Therefore, austerity measures, the only thing they do, apart from being barbaric and unjust, they simply intensify the recession. In other terms, you don't have to be a Keynesian in order to understand that when the economy is frozen, you don't throw on it cold water. Of course, one can argue that it's very important to have both development and financial discipline. But there is a question of time, which Merkel ignores. When you have recession, you emphasize development and not the tightening of the belt. And when things are getting better, when you do have development, then you have to impose certain restrictions. But Merkel does not take into account timing. And therefore, the impact of this policy is pauperization of large sections of the population, growing unemployment, closure of enterprises, the shrinking of the welfare state, and social disorganization. Criminality, suicide rates, state authoritarianism, etc. And therefore, the conclusion is that political integration, if really we want to have a political integration of the Eurozone, one needs less austerity and more aid, not to lend us money, but really to have a Marshall Plan in the way in which Germany profited for a similar plan after the war. In other terms, you cannot have integration without centralized redistribution mechanisms. In the 19th century, on the level of nation states, when the state was not imposing redistribution mechanisms, you had huge inequalities and a massive immiseration of the population. And it is only when, with the organization of the working classes, you had pressure for the development of the welfare state that that these Western European countries achieved more integration, to use Lockwood's terms, greater social integration and system integration. As Habermas has argued, something similar must be done not on the nation state level, but on the level of the European Union, and particularly on the level of the Eurozone. You do need, if you don't have centralized redistribution mechanisms, if you still have just a huge market which is very poorly regulated, then simply integration is not possible, either social integration or system integration. Now, of course, the problem is who can do that today? In the 19th century, it was the working class. Today, who can persuade Germany to provide assistance and help rather than to borrow, to lend money in a way that she gains from this borrowing from the South? It seems to me one possible collective agent who might change things is if the countries of the South Eurozone coordinate their practices, if they create a bloc against German economic imperialism. I don't see why they don't do it. All they do is to argue that my case is not as bad as the Greek case, for instance. In other terms, they just want to persuade the Germans that they are good boys and therefore they need special attention. It seems to me that if a collective actor can change things is if southern countries manage to coordinate their actions against countries like Germany and Finland. Now I move to the national level. Now, if the mobility of capital was the major relevant dimension for understanding the Greek crisis on the global level, and if on the Eurozone level the concept of unequal exchange and the processes of unequal exchange are crucial for understanding the crisis, on the national level, it seems to me the most crucial factor for understanding the present impasse is the post-dictatorial party system. Now, in order to show why this is so, I will adopt a historical perspective. Very briefly, in the 19th century, in Greece, you have what we call oligarchic parliamentarism. That is to say, although we had very early the creation of parliamentary institutions, in the 1820s already, the mass of the population in the 19th century was really outside the national political arena, because people, in a way, their vote was controlled by clientelistic or by more violent means. As far as the elite, the political elites were concerned, we have the so-called zakia, that is to say local potentates, which had a great control of clientelistic networks. Their control was so great that very often, if they moved from one party to another, they could take their votes with them. In other terms, votes was a sort of property which was passing from father to son, etc. Concerning now the party structure, we had what I would call decentralized clientelism, decentralized capitalism, clientelism, in the sense that as far as the organization of the parties was concerned, you had minimal party organization. The party was a sort of club of notables, a club which was really mobilized only during elections, but you didn't have permanent organization in the periphery of the country. And therefore, the leader of the party did not have much power, because the local feudal barons, if you like, the local potentates, had a great deal of autonomy. Moving to the interwar period, up to the junta, 1967-1974, here we have the entrance of the middle classes into the political system, and you have a change of political personnel, you have new people getting into politics, mainly doctors, lawyers, and so forth, and you move, as far as party structure is concerned, to what I would call centralized clientelism. Here you have the development of party organization, you have party offices in some urban centers, but even at that stage, the autonomy of the local elites was great. And that's why, for instance, when Venizelos, the great statesman of the interwar period, when he tried somehow to reduce clientelism and to create kommata archon, as we say, that is to say non-clientelistic parties, horizontally rather than vertically organized, Venizelos failed because the local elites resisted these changes. He was not powerful enough, really, to reduce clientelism. Moving now to the metapolitici, the post-dictatorial party system, here we have the entrance of the popular classes into the political arena. You have again a renewal of political personnel. And as far as the party structure is concerned, I would call it over-centralized mass clientelism. Over-centralized mass clientelism. Concerning the organization of the parties, Andreas Papandreou, as you know, created the first bourgeois mass party. Um, and that in the sense that really party offices penetrated the periphery. In every small town, even in villages, you had off-PASOK offices. And of course, New Democracy followed the same style. And you have clearly a move to mass politics. Concerning now the leadership of the parties, you have a concentration of power at the top. That's why I call this system over-centralized mass clientelism. And a concentration of power at the top in the sense that the cadres of the party, they lost the autonomy they had in the 19th century or during the interwar period. They had no autonomy. You cannot anymore talk about local potentates. They were really the employees of the leader. And of course that meant that someone like Andreas Papandreou, he had an unprecedented amount of power. I think no prime minister had more power than Andreas Papandreou in the 70s and 80s.
Nick, are you okay for 5 minutes?
Sorry? I finished.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. I'm sorry.
No, please.
I'm not very fluent today for some reason. Probably it's age.
We're enticed. We're enticed.
Sorry. I should have gone more quickly, but anyway.
It's fine.
So, in other terms, Venizelos wanted to create Kommata Archon, but he could not. Papandreou could really undermine clientelism, but he did not want to do it. And therefore, what you have in Metapolitics is massification without democratization, without peripheralizing clientelistic and populistic elements that you had before. But now, of course, given that you have mass parties, that means that the negative features of previous parties were intensified. Therefore, you have a massification of corruption, for instance. And also, you have a penetration of the parties and the party logic in all institutional spheres, from the occupations and the artistic sphere till the universities and sports. Therefore, I would argue that in Greece today, you don't have party democracy, you have partocratic democracy. In other terms, parties operate in such a way that they undermine our democratic system. The result of this is that you have a constant transfer of resources from productive to non-productive directions. You have a party system which aims not at bringing about economic growth, but simply bringing about the consolidation and growth of clientelistic networks. You have party attempts to transform economic capital to party political capital. The examples are, let's say, if you take the economic dimension, for instance, the resources, European resources aiming at the modernization of agriculture, was used by PASOK and by Andreas Papandreou to give handouts to farmers who used these resources in order to buy flats in Athens or expensive cars, etc. And to give another example from New Democracy, Karamanlis Jr. used, recruited in a massive clientelistic way, sort of friends of the party, to the state bureaucracy, to the extent that he managed to double, almost double, the national debt. I could give more examples, but I don't have the time. Therefore, you had a system, a party system, where you did not have any controls, because civil society was weak, both for historical reasons and because of the party penetration of all institutional spheres, which could not operate as a counterweight to party expansionism and party corruption. Therefore, you have scandals which were investigated, which were initiated by politicians, but also investigated by politicians, and therefore you never have any punishment of politicians. The final result of all this is, as we know, that you have all sorts of imbalances between exports and imports, between state income and state expenditure, between the low productivity of state enterprises in relation to the private enterprises. And of course, to cover all these imbalances, it was done through borrowing, and therefore the whole system was like a train going fast without brakes. And of course, the final denouement of all this was that the two last democratically elected governments were the most inept, it seems to me, of the post-war period. So let me summarize what I said in 5 points. In order to explain the Greek economic crisis, one should focus on developments not only on the national but also on the global and European levels from the 70s onwards. Second point, on the global level, the neoliberal globalization, which started with the sudden opening of the world financial markets in the 70s, was unique in the sense that state autonomy was reduced and world market mechanisms penetrated the periphery of most countries in such a manner that the movements of capital could not anymore be controlled within national boundaries, this leading to a marked power imbalance between capital and labor. Concerning Greece, these developments led Greek enterprises to move to the northern Balkan area, where labor is cheap and trade unions weak. This flight of capital created unemployment and severe hardship, particularly in northern Greece. Moreover, once the economic crisis intensified, we had a flight of deposits to foreign banks, reducing thus drastically the liquidity of the Greek financial market. The third point, on the Eurozone level, the unequal exchange between the northern developed economies and the less competitive economies of the South led to a systematically induced transfer of resources from the latter to the former. This transfer, given the lack of centralized redistributive mechanism, means that it is not only German taxpayers that helped the Greek economy, It is also Greek taxpayers which indirectly, but on a much greater scale, contribute to the development of the German economy. The long-term process of unequal flows, in combination with the imposition of a draconian economic austerity program, led to the growing freezing of the Greek economy with disastrous effects on unemployment, living standards, and business activity. Fourth point, on the national level, flights of capital, unequal exchange processes within the Eurozone, and Germany's monetarist policies created structural constraints, or rather created a structurally produced social space within which the major actors of the Greek drama, that is to say the clientelistically and populistically oriented political elites, played their game, a game which aimed at maximizing personal and party gains at the expense of the economy and of the country as a whole. This situation, given the weakness of civil society, was bound to lead sooner or later to an impasse. Of course, conjunctural factors like the incompetence of the last two elected governments simply accelerated the process. And finally, a last, more general point related to the theory of social change. When one talks about structural constraints, one should not forget that such constraints or limitations are not fixed entities or essences. What is a constraint for a specific situated actor might be less of a constraint for a more powerful actor involved in the same game. Thus, for instance, for the Greek government, the German imposition of a recessionist program constitutes, if Greece wants to avoid bankruptcy, an unchangeable structural limitation. But Merkel's program is less of a structural constraint for a more powerful Eurozone actor, for instance for the German Social Democrats or the French Socialists, who apparently oppose Merkel's neoliberal strategy. Another way of putting this is to argue that the outcome of macro games played by more powerful actors constitutes structural limitations for less powerful actors involved in meso or micro games. In that sense, my analysis of developments leading to the Greek crisis is based on a conceptualization of actors involved in interrelated, hierarchically organized games which operate in such a manner that the outcomes of global games generate structural constraints for Eurozone actors, whereas in turn Eurozone games set limits to national actors, particularly those of the southern Eurozone countries. Thank you, and I'm very sorry for...
Well, thank you very much, Nicola. If you want to rejoin us, if you want to move here. There's already a lot of questions. I had 27 questions. I think I'm being encouraged to forget those and ask you over sandwiches. Can we go with you?
Thanks. So this is a question and a comment to Professor Archer. Actually, I struggled a bit with your concept of reflexivity. At first, I thought you meant something like the Berger-Lachmann socialization thing. And then I realized that it's not really that. And then you mentioned that reflexivity varies with the nature of social formations. This was on your slide, which to me implies that normal people in a given social formation are reflexive in similar ways. So, to me, that sounds like you're not really giving a discussion of their economic and social position within that society. And you mentioned the dentist example and how the guy walking down the street thinks that the first dentist is too posh. So, to put it more provocatively, given that your first example had this economic aspect brought inside. How is being reflexive different to being class conscious? And my comment is a bit on your critique of the Occupy movement. And you mentioned that they had no clear goal. But the point may not necessarily be to achieve a goal, but to put people together. And if we take a social left position, a kind of Saul Alinsky position, community organizing position, we need to make people realize that they are actors in a community. The political can be self-evident, and creating social ties may be the goal. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to go to your lecture as well. In the last part that you tied reflexivity to the crisis in terms of economic crisis, but while you were speaking, I was tying your notions of reflexivity on the social conflict and the social change Greece is facing, not in an economic terms. So there is definitely a decline of communicative reflexivity. And the stages that you mentioned, that we all know that they are not clear-cut. Traditional modernity, late modernity are not clear-cut. So at this time in point in Greece, in the current social order, you have contextual continuity, you have contextual discontinuity, and you have contextual incongruity. Of course, the contextual continuity is on the decline. But in Greece, community reflexivity was left back in a way, but autonomous reflexivity and meta-reflexivity were not sufficiently cultivated. So, and reflexive skills were not cultivated, either by the political discourse, as we heard Nikos Mouzeli saying, or in terms of educational system. So in that sense, you jumped to fractional reflexivity from community reflexivity, and the other two phases of autonomous reflexivity and meta-reflexivity were not sufficiently developed. So I would tend to think, for example, that the Occupy groups are, in a way, reclaiming communicative reflexivity, and that's why they're appealing, but at the same time do not offer an alternative, because there is not there sufficient autonomous reflexivity and meta reflexivity. Just
that. Yeah, lovely analysis.
Another question before we finish this round, gentlemen here.
The solution to what's going on now, I mean, given a dysfunctional, kind of semi-functional political state in Greece at the moment, is somehow for that to be kind of supported by some sort of transfer mechanism as a kind of solution. That's what I got from your critique.
Sorry, can I just ask, a transfer mechanism, what do you mean?
A transfer mechanism from the north to the south.
Oh, I see, sorry, a financial transfer mechanism.
Financial transfer,
sorry, yes.
To almost support sort of like a dysfunctional kind of state. And it kind of just didn't sit very, very, maybe I misunderstood, but it didn't sit at all pleasantly with myself. And I think it's part of the sort of northern attitude is that, you know, given a dysfunctional state, their logic is to kind of snuff it out, almost, as it were, force change. And, you know, let's say a democracy
okay.
may have been abandoned
okay.
to some degree in terms of a technocratic sort of
okay.
Government. But the Greek people also have
the
choice to leave in Britain.
Sorry? The Greek people?
May also have a choice to leave the Eurozone as well. And, you know, take things on their own.
Yeah.
Think.
Okay. We're up against the time. But, Margaret, do you want to go first and then Nikos?
Can we skip the historical bit? There is more to life than class consciousness. Reflexivity is about everything that we care about. Our kids, everything. So, no, when you're giving a historical panorama that goes from sort of beginning to now, class consciousness is just one element of it. An important one, of course, but not total.
rather inarticulate howl of protest as a place marker, as a, well, you actually say, as a beginning of community, could, well, yes, it could forge certain bonds, but to what end? Now, these are not real communities. I've got a colleague who's studying them, goes there about every day a week in Geneva. Most of them don't sleep there. Most of them don't eat there. Most of them go to work if they've got jobs. So it's a very elective, now I'm not knocking it for this, but yes.
But it's just bringing people together, isn't it?
Bringing people together. But yes, we can say network, but there are huge problems with network theory. The first one being that it isn't a theory, it's a description. Now that this is another domain altogether, and it's an interesting one, for how these groups, the most prominent ones in Europe, occupied groups, they are digitally connected. And it's the who they're digitally connected to that gives me some sort of hope. Because they seem to be linking up with the peer-to-peer groups, the cyber commons groups, the let's talk about use value, not market value. In other words, all those technological innovations which do not need, as they have done in recent history, just to feed into the finance game and its ever-increasing complexities and occlusion of real people from understanding what's really going on. Really, what's going on is high crime. Whether it's legal or illegal becomes a less and less relevant kind of distinction. We used to be able to talk about the black and the white economy. We can't do that anymore. It's vanished. It's one of Castells' best insights, you know, when I'm going back to 2000.